on hockey. Because being a Flyer fan, and Jake likes to watch fighting. He likes to fight. So being a Flyer fan, I turned him on the Flyers, and obviously Simmons was his favorite player. And so he got hooked on the Flyers and Simmons and all this. And then while we were making the record, but he lives in Vegas, so it was going through the Vegas expansion draft and, like, the announcing of the team name and then the colors and then the design of the game sweaters. And so we went through, as we were making the record, the whole growth process of the Vegas Knights franchise, peaking at the Stanley Cup, like, as we were mixing. It was like the Vegas Knights grew with Patina simultaneously. It was incredible. And he went to a couple of Stanley Cup games last Cup in Vegas, and he only had, I bought him a Simmons game sweater for Christmas last year. So he actually wore the Simmons game sweater to the Vegas game in Vegas in the Cup. And, like, people gave him that, like, crazy props because it was Simmons and it was the Flyers, you know. But the people that were taking him to the games ended up buying him, like, an England jersey. And so now he's got, like, 3 Vegas Knights jerseys just because people didn't want him to wear the Flyer ones to the Knights games anymore. But, yeah, I got him hooked on hockey. He's full-blown hockey.
And once you've seen him live, once you've been to a couple games live, especially playoff games, then that's it. You're hooked, right? Like, there's no way.
Totally. And we had the center ice package on the ranch where we record at my ranch. So my son's a Ranger fan. I'm a Flyer fan. Jake's a Knights fan. So we got to watch, like, I mean, there was always a game or maybe 2 games on a night of our teams, and it was so worth it, you know, just watching. Like, we'd have the center ice package on in the studio while we were tracking. We'd watch games. Sometimes we wouldn't start recording until after the nights were over. You know, like, it was crazy.
Wow. You guys were, I got to ask you then, what do you think of this new Flyers mascot there? What's his name?
Gritty,
yeah.
I love Gritty. Gritty's cool because Flyers could come up with a mascot that, like, instills fear into the youth crowd. You know, like, they didn't go for something like cuddly and like this. He looks like Jake said it, and he said it perfectly. He goes, he looks like a Muppet on meth. And it's kind of cool. Like Gritty's, like, he symbolizes the Flyers. The Flyers are not a pretty franchise. You know, we're like the Raiders on ice, you know. So it's kind of cool.
Yeah, he's growing on me, I have to admit. The first time I saw him, I was wondering what the hell they were thinking. But, yeah, like, he's growing on me. I mean, he's definitely got character, right? At least he's got character.
He fits the city of Philly a lot, you know. Like, that's just the Philly working class. Like, you know, Philly fans are insanely intense and passionate, like with the Eagles and the Flyers. I mean, they're so into it, and they're such great fans. And he definitely typifies the Philly fans. He's a perfect mascot, I think. He grows on you, like you said.
Man, you know what we should probably do is introduce you.
That seems a good idea. Let's do that.
We jump right in. People are going to be like, this is great, but who are they talking to? Welcome to We Talk Music. I am the Crown Prince of Charisma, Mo, and this is the King of the Casters, Brett Podcast. Mr. Brett Podcast. He's the Chief Defender of the Faith. And you are Anthony Esposito of Red Dragon Cartel. And, you know, you've been around for a while, but that's the current project with Jake Healy. So we wanted to get that out there. Like you said, you have a new album, Patina. And now we can get back to hockey.
Yeah, exactly. We haven't scored a goal in 2 games now. Our offense is crushing horrible.
So you truly are just like the Raiders then?
Oh my God. I literally watched the game last night against the Devils. We had 6 posts that we hit. Like game of inches, but forget it. It's like, it was so frustrating watching it. And like, it was, anyway. And then we get Tampa coming in on Saturday, and they're on fire, so.
Yeah, but their goalie's out now. You know, they're starting goalies out. So that might change things for them. We'll see.
Well, we can't seem to score anyway, so.
Well, I'm hoping that the new Red Dragon album, Red Dragon Cartel album, Patina, scores more goals than the Flyers are right now.
we're trying to, because of our lawyer, incredible, great lawyer.
Nobody's ever said that before.
No, but he's so awesome. We renegotiated the whole year of 2016 was Jake renegotiating his recording contract with our record label, and he did it after he negotiated the contract for a year. Jake and I asked him, like, well, we probably owe you a lot of money. What's our bill? What's the compensation? He's like, I just want to play one power chord on the album.
Wow!
Like, awesome. We could do that. So, We let Todd play a power chord before one of the songs, and Jake and my son Tyler, who also engineered the record, they worked like the tape delay echoplexes and stuff and made it sound huge and sweeping and panned and stuff. And that was paid off our legal bill. And but Todd handles a lot of the Flyer players. He's an avid Flyer fan. He's actually billed on the record as Todd Let's Go Flyers is on the record as his credit. But he handles a lot of the players' non-for-profits and stuff, and he's trying to get Havana or Speedbag to be played at the Flyer games when they, like, score a goal or when they skate out on the ice at the beginning of the period or something like that. We're lobbying for that right now.
Oh, that'd be great.
That would be wicked, yeah.
I know, we're big hockey fans. Like, we really are. Like, we're a band that really, we're into hockey. Like, it's our... You know, it's definitely our thing.
Did you get anybody when you played Flame Central before? Did you get anybody else in that band who was a hockey fan?
No. Ace likes the Yankees. I went to a couple Yankee games with Ace. That was always neat. We parked. I remember riding on our Harleys to the Yankee games, and we'd park in the player parking lot, and then we'd get. The Yankees would give him really great seats, and then they'd show him up on the big screen, and they'd play, like, you know, New York Groove over the PA or something like that. Ace is more of a baseball fan, Yankee fan. I mean, he's from the Bronx, born and raised, you know. So, but most musicians aren't really into sports for the most part. But Ace was into baseball, and the other guys in the band were more football orientated. Like Coogan, the drummer, was a Charger fan, and all that. I had Jet season tickets since I was, like, you know, born. My dad had them since they were the Titans. And I have a photo of, like, Namath holding me, and I was like a year old. And Namath holding me at training camp, you know.
Oh yeah, are you still a Jet season ticket holder then, or?
No, I let it go. I moved to about 10 years ago. I bought a ranch, which is where we recorded the album and
Up Scenic Art Studios, correct?
Yeah. We filmed all the videos and recorded the album here. And I moved here 10 years ago, so the present state of the Jets isn't worth a 3-hour trip to go see them play. Actually, it was funny because we had seniority out of season ticket holders for my dad, and I called the Jets and said we weren't upping it, and they were like, why? Well, you know, we'll comp you, we'll move you down in the stadium, we'll comp you parking, and they were offering me this sweet deal, and I was like, no, I don't want to renew, and they're like, why? And I was like, two words, and they were like, what? I go, Tim Tebow. I go, now we have two quarterbacks. Now we have two quarterbacks that can't throw 15 yards because we had Sanchez and Tebow at that time. So I canceled it. And the guy was like, yeah, I understand. Okay. I'm like, it's not worth a 6-hour round trip to go see Tim Tebow play quarterback.
No kidding. Or Sanchez. I mean, I thought they had something in Sanchez for a while there. And then I was wrong.
Yeah. The first two Rex years were kind of hopeful, but then it's been downhill since, you know.
Yeah. I was actually looking at the website for the studios there, Obscenic Arts, and I was just seeing all the cool people that have recorded there over the years. You know, you had a Joan Jett and Psychedelic Furs, I think. And
yeah, no, it originally started out in I owned, when I got off the road with Lynch Mob in like 93 or whatnot, I needed a place to store my traveling gear, my touring rig. And so I rented this space for 15 years on 27th Street. And it started out just my band and some high school friends jamming. And then people would come to that rehearsal and they'd be in bands and go, hey, man, can we rehearse here like two nights a week? We'll help with the rent. And then before you know it, like, I had every band in New York rehearsing there. And then another one of my friends had a recording gear, and he was like, well, can we record jingles and stuff during the day in the space? And so then the bands would come in at night and see the recording rig sitting there and want to record demos to get gigs and stuff. So then that's how the recording studio started. And it grew and grew and grew. And I used to sleep on the floor at the studio and shower at the Y just so I didn't have to pay rent in Manhattan on an apartment. And I'd save my money and buy gear like mics and compressors and recording consoles and everything. And it just kept growing and growing. And the last CD that we recorded there was Ace's Anomaly record. And yeah, we had the Ramones, the New York Dolls, the Misfits, and Green Day was in there. And then I was touring with Ace, and my 15-year lease was up, and the neighborhood I was in went from Hell's Kitchen to Chelsea. So the guy wanted to like quadruple my rent. And I was like, you know, that's not cool. And I closed the studio. And then when I moved out here, I reopened it. And now it's like this killer destination studio. It's a 10-acre horse ranch, and bands stay on the ranch. And, you know, the drum room is like a 3-car garage, pre-Civil War carriage house. And it's just an amazing place to create music. And bands come and they stay on the ranch. And I produce everything from, like, you know, baby band, high school bands, all the way up to, like, national acts, you know. And, you know, it's just fun, you know.
Well, that sounds amazing. I want to come.
Yeah, we're like we got to come for some sort of tour. Yeah. We're going to stay there. We're not going to record anything. We're just going to stay at your ranch anyways.
Yeah, Jake was here for a year and a half when we were doing the record.
Oh, man, that's amazing. Man, and you had, those names you throw out are unbelievable. Yeah, the greatest of all time, the Ramones in there. It's unbelievable.
Well, I played in a band for a minute. In between Lynch Mob and Ace, I played in this band called The Remains for a minute with Marky and Dee Dee and CJ. It was The Remains of the Ramones. And then Dee Dee had moved to L.A. and passed away. But they were in and out. All the time, you know. And Dee Dee lived at the Chelsea, which was 3-4 blocks from the studio. So before he passed, he would just come up and knock on the door and bring coffee, and we would just shoot the shit and you know, talk about music and everything. And you know, he would always do flyby drop ins, you know. But they were great. They're legends, you know.
Well, I mean, yeah, you know, to fans like us, I know. You have certainly been blessed to play with so many great musicians and so many great guitarists. I mean, from George Lynch to Ace Frehley, and finally, you know, to Jakey Lee. It's amazing to track your career, because I remember your name on that first Lynch Mob album, because, you know, I was just incessantly reading the liner notes, because I'm always like, oh, who's going to be playing with somebody else next? It's fascinating.
That's a great album. That was, I was so lucky and blessed to be part of that album. I was 22 when we made that album, and it was basically my first real jaunt into the whole situation. And it was just one of those things where George was coming off Lynch Dokken, and he wanted to prove, you know, there was always that fight with him and Don, and he wanted to prove like what his worth was to that band, and he had a chip on his shoulder. And then you had Oni and I, who were basically newcomers, providing the freshness aspect and point of view of it. And you have Mick, who's one of the most solid rock drummers there ever was and is. And it was just a perfect storm, with Max Norman being there involved, and in the beginning, Neil Kernan being involved. And I was just blessed to be put into that situation that early of an age. I really still to this day don't really realize the magnitude of what was happening at that time, because I was greener than center field in Yankee Stadium on opening day, and I was just so happy and that I didn't realize the reality of the situation, which probably was a good thing. And very proud to be part of that. But yeah, I mean, I understand George and Ace guitar players, yeah, but Jake's a musician. To call Jake a guitar player is selling him short. Jake's a classically trained pianist. I mean, he's an incredible musician. He doesn't think of songs in the mono of guitar line riff only. Like, he looks at it as a chunk of music, and if the bass is doing this and the melody's doing that, the guitar will be layering this, and then we'll have this behind that, and the drums should be playing in this kind of vein against that pattern. Like, he's a musician. He's a sculptor when he approaches a work of music, and that I hope that comes across on Patina. They're not very, they're the kind of songs that you listen to, as a listener, and hopefully they pull you in more to where you start listening, like in the old days with headphones, like you listen to a Floyd record or a Zeppelin record, and you hear all this other stuff going on around it in the background, and there's stuff, you know, we call it ear candy, you know, and it just starts popping out, and then you go to try to play it, and you're like, holy shit, he's playing that? Fuck! Can't play that. You know, to play it right, or where it is on the neck, or how he's stretching, or, you know, like, he's very, very aware of, no, playing this in this position on the neck to get this tonal quality as against what I'm doing on guitar here. Like, he's not just a guitar player. He's an artist. Like, he's a musician in the highest sense, which is a pleasure at this point in my career to get to play with someone with that amount of talent is so nice and refreshing. And I learned a lot, you know, at this point in my life. I learned a lot about music by just being in a room with him, you know?
How long had you known Jake before you joined the band?
Well, I met, there's a photo floating around. There used to be a bar when I joined Lynch Mob in, like, I don't know, 89. There was a bar in Phoenix. Lynch Mob was based in Phoenix, so I moved from New York to Phoenix, and there was a bar called the Mason Jar in Phoenix. And I was friends with Ray from New York, because Ray Gillen was from New York. So I knew Ray before I met Jake. And Ray, they were playing, Badlands was playing the Mason Jar, and Ray had called me, and he's like, yo, man, Ant-Man, come down, you know, we're doing sound check. And then, after sound check, Ray and I went, and he got tattooed by a really great friend of mine who became a really close, dear friend of mine, this guy named JJ, who played bass and Fight, and he tattoos everybody from, you know, Chino and the Deftones to, you know, he did Kerry King's Slayer, half that tribal body work, and it's all his, he's a phenomenal tattooist, but he played bass and Fight with Rob after when Rob quit Judas Priest. But I met Jake at soundcheck at the Mason Jar on the Badlands tour before Wicked even came out. And then we got really close. MTV used to do those rock and jock stuff, and we did the race car. It was like a Grand Prix race team, MTV All-Star Celebrity Race Team. And Jake was doing it, and George and I, and Nick did it. And we were, so we went to, you have to get certified to be on the track. So we went to school for it, Bob Bondurant School of High Performance Driving. So we went to school for 3 or 4 days, got certified, and then we did, I think it was either the Denver Grand Prix or the Detroit Grand Prix, where we were on the track right before the Indy cars were, you know, like we were like the halftime show. Put a couple of rockers out on the, and let them just, you know, bang up and have accidents all over the course. But yeah, that's where I got to know Jake a lot better. But there's a photo from that night at the Mason Jar, and it was like Rob Halford, and it was myself and George and Jake and Ray, and we're all in this big photo and from that night that I met Jake.
You're literally, we're just sitting here thinking, dude, you've had the coolest life. Like, we really are. Like, we just listen to these names.
Exploded against the walls in here. It's just, I mean, when do you hear that?
I never know, but literally, I never look back. Like right now, I'm always looking forward to do. What's next? What are we going to do next? What, you know, like what's tomorrow bring? That you only really, I only look back when I talk about it with like on an interview of friends or somebody who asks me a question or whatnot, I really don't like, I'm always going forward in the next thing and creating it. That you don't even realize over the course of what the stories are or the things that you've created over time, because you're so concentrated and focused on the next thing, you know, or the moment that's happening right now, you know.
Well, yeah, because you joined Red Dragon Cartel quite early. I think it was like 2015 or something like that. And
yeah, they had the problem. It was like right after the singer Darren and Jake had a discussion, and they thought it would be better that they took a time out, and then they had a revolving door of singers. And the thing was that the original management and the original business partner with Jake didn't really handle Jake's comeback or that first album very well. And Jake told him, you know, my back is not what it used to be and my wrist is not what it used to be, that you can't book too many shows in a row. I physically can't do them. And they would book like 5 shows, 6 shows in a row. And he's like, I can't do them. Please cancel them. And they would never cancel them. And it made him look really bad, because he would have to cancel it last minute. So he had all these dates that he had to go back and make up. And Greg had gotten sick. Greg replaced the bass player, Greg from Badlands. He had gotten sick, so he couldn't go out. So that was when Jake was like, would you be interested in being part of it? And I was like, yeah, hell yeah. When do you want me? What do I got to learn? Where am I at? And we did that summer run with all the 4 different singers that were auditioning on the road while we were making up those gigs. None of them were ever in the band. And then Darren came back. We did 2 shows in California and 3 shows in Japan. And then we started writing the record.
You know, it's interesting you bring that up, because you guys have announced your American tour. Coming up, I think February 23rd, you're starting, and it's a pretty intense tour. I think it's 27 shots in 35 days or something like that.
Yeah, and every day off is an 800-mile ride on the bus. I mean, it's like, yeah, okay, Colorado to San Antonio on your day off. Oh, it's only 850 miles. You know, it's like,
yeah.
We're starting in Reno. There was an amazing bar that we used to love to play at in San Jose called the Rock Bar. And that was the place that we played where the bus caught on fire.
Right before we Yeah.
The Hummer stretch limo that picked us up at the airport caught on fire on its way back to the club. But the couple that owned the Rock Bar in San Jose moved the bar to Reno, to the Golden Nugget, and they really wanted us to start the tour at their place. So Jake loves them, like, dearly. They're friends, and so that's where we're going to kick it off. And then we go to California and Arizona and Colorado and Texas and work our way to the Northeast. But going back to the business partner and the management on the first CD, they kind of took gigs that Jake probably shouldn't have taken, and for money that Jake probably shouldn't have agreed to per gig. So now we're doing this first run, hopefully with the excitement about the record, and doing this first run to try to sell out and prove to the promoters and that we can do business better than what was done on the first album cycle, live business and stuff. And then after that, this run is kind of like a proof to the promoters that we can, that we're still valid and viable. And then I know we're going to Japan, and then I think we're going to come back and do more in the States, you know, and I know we're going to...
And Calgary.
Europe. There's Europe as well. It's not just that run, and then we're gone.
And Calgary, right? In the States and Calgary.
I think the only date we're doing in Canada on that one is Toronto.
Toronto, I know. And, I'm like, what the hell?
And our singer, yeah, but our singer's from Toronto.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
So if Darren can't pack that place, you know. But yeah, no, we played that place in Toronto on the last run that I was involved in. It did really well, so we're going back. We basically wanted to play places that we can draw well, and then when the promoters go to Polestar, they go, oh, they drew this amount, and, you know, they're worthy of... Because we can't, because of Jake's physical state, we can't tour in a van. His back in a van. We need a bed in on a bus, you know. And that requires a certain amount of overhead a week to be able to afford that. And we wouldn't be able to do it that way on the gigs and the guarantees that they've accepted on the first touring cycle. Does that make sense?
No, and it's really interesting, and it's something that I really enjoy about talking to you is the fact that I know you, from having done it with Ace, like, you understand that business side, and there is a real interest in that business side, you know, from our perspective as well.
Like, here's a perfect example. Like, they played a place on that last album cycle, a tiny little club in Philly that's not there anymore, so I'll talk about it. It was called J.C. Dobbs. And, like, they played on a Friday night for, like, no money. And because the club is so small and the guarantee was so low, the promoter doesn't promote it because he knows he's going to make the money in the bar anyway to cover the show. So he doesn't have to go out and buy advertising time. So most people don't even know about it. So the place only holds 150, 200 people at best, and you're only getting this low amount of money. So then when you go to book a Friday night in Milwaukee, that promoter will log on to Pollstar and go, well, you played Philly on a Friday night for that amount of money. Why do I have to pay that amount times X? And you only drew that amount of people in Philly on a Friday, so why do I have to pay more? Like, the precedent was set very low, and it just basically took any gig as opposed to being wise. But now Jake has an amazing manager that I'm so happy Jake decided to partner up with him, and the train is on the right track, and we made the kind of record that deserves the to be on the right track, you know.
Yeah, it's always interesting because I can always remember saying to Mo, like, after we would find out that a band played in Calgary, and it's just like, why did we not know about this? Like, we're big fans, and yet we didn't find out about these bands that are coming through Calgary. So I think that really
So where do you usually get the information of somebody's playing?
Well, nowadays I think we have to. I know that I myself have to dig through Facebook a lot more to try to get
back in the day. The ads were on the radio. Mm-hmm. Now radio doesn't play 90% of the bands that I'd want to go see anyway.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to be occasionally hearing Friday Night Live at the Giant Center. It's Tesla with, you know, Rat and or whatever it is. Those ads don't exist because they don't play that music on the radio anymore. So you don't have that outlet. All the magazines that used to be in the bars that would show the club ads for the club of bands coming up and stuff. I grew up in New York, so it was the Village Voice or whatever, the Aquarian or whatever. Those magazines don't have the circulation anymore because of the internet. So to find out who's playing at that local bar, if you don't go to that local bar's page on Facebook or their website or are following them that post is going to come up, that we're playing there, you're never going to know.
Yeah, it's true. Like, there's nothing that's...
Brent needs to turn his... every single show this happens where he gets a text message that loud.
Jeff Beck just played 10 minutes from my house.
Are you
kidding?
Found
out about it 2 weeks after Jeff Beck played.
Oh, God.
You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Somebody's not doing their job. Somebody's dropping the ball.
Yeah, for sure. Because there's just no, like, good catch-all where you can just find out all of the good shows.
And there are sites out there that I think they want to do that, and they try and do that, but it's still not accessible enough, I think, to the people, you know. It's a weird thing. I mean, where's the last time I found out about a good concert? Was actually opening Google Play Music and saying, playing near you, listening to their album, you know?
I have a neat app. It's called Bands in Town.
Oh, yeah.
And, that's a great app because it'll go into your iTunes, and any bands that you have on your iTunes, any songs or bands you have downloaded, if they're coming to your area, you'll get a message.
Yeah, for sure. I'm seeing more things, so I'm finding more now. But yeah, it's just a really interesting thing to kind of you know, realize now how much things have changed in the music industry.
And I mean, also too, I mean, we just finished our third and fourth video. We released our third video today, and the fourth one's being edited now. Probably will come out in a month. But Bitter, the video for Bitter was literally released on YouTube about an hour ago. And
it's great.
And we're doing all these interviews. We're just trying to, any blog, any satellite radio, anything that we could do to get the word out to people, because it seems like nowadays labels and radio, they're preached to the choir. They already preach to the people that are into the band already, that are going to take the 5 minutes and search for it and hunt it out. They're not going to the rest of the people to broaden the following, you know?
Well, it's true. I mean, it has to be grassroots now. You have to go to, I'm not suggesting that we're not the biggest in out there, but you know, we do our best, and I mean, we're trying, and I think we're part of that grassroots movement.
Everything counts. Everything counts because everything with the internet is global. Everything from that little handheld iPhone from that show in Philly that 50 people were there, that gets uploaded and somebody in Russia could watch that clip. Like, everything on the internet is global. So there is no big or small anymore. Everything is the same, has the potential for the same viewing or listening audience, you know?
For sure, for sure. Now, you talk about that Bitter video, and I really enjoyed it. I thought it was great fun, and great to see a video that was like that, especially, and when you compare it to the other videos, it's eye-catching in that regard.
Mm-hmm. We wanted something that showed the personality of the band, because most videos are performance-based, and, you know, you're really not, most musicians, you know, go through the phone booth Superman change into the stage persona performance guy when they strap their guitar on or pick up their drumsticks or grab that vocal mic. They go into the performance mode, and we kind of wanted to show that, you know, we're lighthearted, we're funny, we're a funny band, we have a blast together, and in that bar it's like we basically took over this amazingly old school, old man drinking bar in Harrisburg that was family owned since 1950, called Quigley's. And we basically took it over for a day. They're like, sure, shoot the video, just cover your bar tab and your food costs. And we're like, all right, cool. So we got all our friends in there, and we're like, drink as much as you want, eat as much as you want, and we're just going to film. And that came across, like everybody was smoking and drinking and eating and just shooting pool and sitting at the bar, and everybody got, like, you know, had a good time and fun, and that came across in it. You know, we don't always have to be serious, you know.
No, I know when I first clicked on the video, I didn't know what to expect because the song title is Bitter. So you're not expecting this lighthearted video, and then I'm like, oh, this is really good. This is really it was uplifting.
The title is deceiving. It's like bitters, not bitter.
Yeah.
It's like in a drink, you have bitter.
Yeah.
You know, bitters.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Big fan of them, actually.
We're not bitter at all.
No, I know, and that's the thing that I think that's interesting that video does such a good job of conveying the band's personality.
Oh yeah, because
if anything, Crooked Man is more about us being bitter than yeah. Bitter is.
Yeah, no doubt about that. That one shows off the bitter side. But yeah,
Crooked Man is, the lyrics are basically they're pointed at certain people. And it's pretty easy to figure out who we wrote it about and the few people in life that we've come across that have created that in us, you know.
Well, it's just so much better when you can be when you can laugh and have a good time and not have to deal with that kind of, you know, bullshit. Yeah. Ultimately.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the thing. A band is almost like a sports team, right? Is that you gotta? It's the chemistry is as important as the talent.
Yeah,
and
yes, it definitely is like that.
You know, and the same thing also that also includes the people don't necessarily think about behind the scenes that are helping bands and put together the shows and the production and everything like that. But
well, we couldn't have made we couldn't have made the CD or the videos if it wasn't for like guys like Joe Gorelick, who is our director and did all the photos for the CD and all the graphic design. Basically, he did do them for nothing, and we wouldn't have been able to make a quality of a product, a quality of insight to the band or the look of the band, all of that stuff, without him being incredibly talented as well and donating his skills to us because he believes in the band. For what the budgets are nowadays, I mean, you know, you're basically paid enough to, like, the flights to get the band to one place was more than the video budget was to shoot the video.
Wow.
Oh, yeah, that's crazy. I wonder if I can ask you a question that's kind of a little bit out there, a little bit off the beaten track, but just because it's come up today. Now, I wonder if you could tell me, in your opinion, you pick one song, you get one song that kind of encapsulates the 80s. What song would that be?
The 80s?
Yeah.
You know, I'm probably not the one to ask, because I didn't really get into quote-unquote metal until I auditioned for Lynch Mob. Like, I wasn't listening to rock that much when I was in high school and stuff. Like, I was into punk rock. Like, I was listening to The Clash and The Police and The Jam and The Buzzcocks and The Pistols, and I was listening to jazz. Like a lot of my teachers and stuff were jazz players and stuff. So I'm like, my thing of the 80s wouldn't be what you would think a metal guy would pick, you know?
That makes it an even better answer.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting.
So are you asking what song from the 80s would be a soundtrack to my 80s, or what song lyrically sums up the emotion of the 80s?
I think the second one there.
Which song sums up the emotion of the 80s?
I think so, yeah.
Now, I don't know. I mean, In Excess, What You Need?
Interesting. Interesting.
Because it was such a period of excess, the 80s.
Yes.
And anything doing was worth overdoing, and everything was in abundance, and the financial climate was a lot better in, I don't know about Canada, but in the States, everybody seemed to have money, everybody seemed to have a good job, everybody seemed to have fun when they went out. And they went out more than one night a week, and everybody was playing large venues, and people were going to see bands in large venues at large quantities. And the whole, like, feeling of the 80s, people weren't so stressed. They weren't month to month, bill to bill, check to check. It was more open and fun, and any, like I said, anything worth doing is worth overdoing, you know. So what you need kind of was like about what you need, but doing more than what you needed.
Oh, that's a good answer. Very interesting. Back to this album, though, because you're always
90s,
moving.
Then the 90s depressed everybody.
Well, you know, it's funny because I was doing this with people and asking their 70s what song. In the 90s, when I think of the 90s, I think the two songs is either Smells Like Teen Spirit and You Got a Sweat by CNC. Those came out in the same year by CNC Music Factory.
Well, it was definitely Seattle. And the 90s was Seattle.
Yeah.
And then you had the post rock bands that were kind of riding the Matchbox 20 sound that was kind of like a cross between Matchbox 20 and Pearl Jam. You know, like there were all those bands that the Marcy Playgrounds and all those other bands, that the one-hit wonders of the mid-90s and the Fuels and those kind of bands. But 90s definitely, I think, was dominated by Seattle, which was a very furious, dark, depressing, reality-based music and society. It was like Bear Down. It was almost like the winter, where the 80s were more like spring and summer.
Yeah.
You know, I can see that definitely. And then you move into today, and I couldn't even tell you what this century's, you know, song is. I mean, I don't know, there's, you know, certainly not of these rap metal albums. I wonder, what did he think about when Lynchmob did a rap metal album? What did the name was on it?
That's not Lynchmob, that's Lynch Biscuit.
It must have been odd for you.
There's nobody on that record from Lynchmob except for George, and it shouldn't have been called Lynchmob.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, that's kind of how I felt about it as a fan, too. Like, you know, I almost felt ripped off in that way.
People feel obligated to keep me up to date with Lynchmob and their present situations. But I remember when that record came out that people were actually burning it and throwing it on stage and buying shirts at the merch counter and setting them on fire and throwing them at the band. But, I mean, that's what I was told.
Wow. Well, how about merchandise? What do you take a large part in that in the band and thinking of ideas, or is that something you guys toss around a lot, or is that left to somebody else?
Well, with Ace liked to do graphic art on his computer, so all the shirts he designed and put on shirts, and I thought they never made good T-shirts. I think T-shirts should be simple and bold, and they were always kind of too busy and too intricate for a shirt, I thought. In Lynchmob, I had a lot to do with it. I had a lot to do with the image of Lynchmob back then, and that was kind of like my, the visual aspect, like why Lynchmob didn't look like Dokken. I always thought Dokken was cheesy and wimpy and like too silly, and Lynchmob wasn't that way. I said, if you're going to make timeless music, you wear timeless clothing. And you market the band, you brand the band timeless. You don't wear silly little outfits, leather outfits that match, that, you know, are dated. It's almost like a drum machine or a keyboard machine on a track will always be dated to the advancement of the technology at that moment. You're dating the sound by being tied to a technology advancement. Or progress, you know. The same way I thought with visuals of a band, if you want to create something timeless, the image should be timeless. So we went to Levi's and, like, well-crafted leather, simple pants like Jim Morrison would wear, or the image completely changed from docking. And I remember Oni and I burning all the wrestling sneakers and the spandex that was in the wardrobe cases when we first started the band.
There was a bunch of really spandex and everything. That's actually hard to imagine even with the band.
Well, Dokken wore spandex with wrestling sneakers and silly leather outfits, and we didn't want that for Lynchmob. We wanted something timeless. Like my I always asked. I was like, would James Dean wear? Would Elvis wear? You want to be timeless. You want to create something that's timeless with your music. Then you need to present it with a timeless feel, a visually, you know?
And how about with Red Dragon Cartel? There's, you know, nowadays you have
that to... That's all Jake. It's all off Jake. I don't know. It's not a band. It's Jake. It's about as much a band as Nine Inch Nails is, like Trent Reznor is to Nine Inch Nails. Jake is to Red Dragon Cartel. And, you know, he will... occasionally ask my opinion on things or listen to my opinion on things and judge it. But everything begins, starts, and ends and with Jake's decision. I don't know with the merch. Jake has a really great fashion sense, like visually on how he presents himself. He's got a great taste in you know, what he wears and the way his guitars look. And, you know, so I have no doubts that the merch would be great, but I don't know how much involvement I'll have in it. Like I said, it's not a band. I'm an employee. I'm an employee that contributes a lot, because he does ask a lot from me, of my opinion and my perception of things, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting because I know that you co-produced the album with him and stuff like that. And I do, you know, from talking to you and from learning about you, I know that you have a lot to give in that case. So, I mean, I'm, you know, from my concept, you know, I'm glad that you're able to be to give that to him. And I hope that it the band exists for a long time with you in it, because I think that, I mean, people go in wanting Jake E. Lee, but there's no doubt that when you find that cohesion within a band, it's nice to try to keep it together.
Well, I mean, hopefully Jake feels the same way, and he'll want me around for an extended period of time. And I have a tendency of saying the wrong thing at some time. So I hope I don't piss him off while voicing my opinion. I'm a very black and white type of guy. I don't do gray very well. And hopefully he'll take it, you know, from where it comes at the moment. But I'm interested in being around as long as he wants me around, you know. As a producer, as co-producing this with him, I approached it in my mind before we started that I thought the first record was not a good comeback record for Jake E. Lee. I thought it was a record that was made for rock radio that doesn't exist anymore. I think there wasn't enough guitar playing on it, and there wasn't any cohesion as a band. You're calling it Red Dragon Cartel. If you called it Jake E. Lee and had all these guest singers and guest drummers and guest players on it, then it would work. But if you're trying to build a band and a band name and a band brand, you need the band on the first album. And there was only, I think they were only on like three songs as a band. And I thought that was a mistake. And I entered this wanting to hear more guitar. Honestly, I don't think there was enough guitar on it. And Jake's a phenomenal musician and a phenomenal guitar player. And I really wanted to hear the riffs again. And you know what? He was on the same page. I never even had to say it to him, because he had entered the room with that in mind already. So it was one of the, like, a good producer knows when to shut the fuck up and let the artists do what they do, because what they do and why they're at that point and why they're that renowned is because they have something very special to offer. So a good producer knows not when not to open his mouth and to listen and to get the best out of the person by helping them express what's already in their brain, you know?
Yeah, for sure. And there's no question. I mean, from listening to the album, like, Jake's playing is front and center, and it's spectacular. And as well,
it should be. He's so gifted.
But as well, you know, the sound is, as I said, you know, it has that cohesion. And I think that makes it a better album.
Yeah, and absolutely. I mean, it's an album that I could picture almost everybody saying they have a different favorite song, and that's a good thing.
But you notice you said album?
Yes. Yeah, true.
Nobody says album anymore.
Yeah.
It's a singles-based society. They go to iTunes and they download a song. We made an album. And to me, an album is like a house, right? I was working with this band last night, the Moonlight March, right? And I'm saying, an album is like a house, and each song is like a room. When you decorate a house, you don't decorate every room the exact same way, because then it would be boring. You know, you may have your daughter's bedroom, you may have a den, you may have a dining room, you'll have the master bedroom for the married couple, the son's room. Each room has its own vibe and its own place and it's telling its own story. But when all those rooms are put together, they create a house, and that house has a foundation. And when you're in that house, you know you're in that house, even though the rooms may be different a little bit or whatnot, they're still part of that house. And the album is the house, and each song is a different story that you're telling, so it's a different room.
Yeah. Oh, that's
great. Yeah. No. That's a. You know, I'm sitting here absorbing. Like, I feel like I'm under the learning tree. You know, sometimes I'm just sitting here absorbing some of the things you're saying, and seeing how it can be applied to different things. So, you know, I really appreciate
like
that.
Ink and water is, I mean, very, very different than Havana, but you still know it's on band.
Mm-hmm.
You still
absolutely
know it's on the same album.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. I mean, it's an excellent album that deserves repeat listens so that you, as you say, you can catch all of those little things, because I think that's just so important to be able to give it that. And it's an unfortunate trend with the music industry leaning towards the singles, because the albums do tend to get marginalized sometimes.
Yes. Yes. And then like, we're having a difficult time figuring out what we're going to play live, because we like the whole album in its entirety. And, like, you know, so what do we do? We'll play a couple of songs off the first record. We're not doing any Ozzy songs, because Jake felt they're Ozzy songs, even though he was part of them. He feels like he's playing an Ozzy song, and he doesn't feel right playing them, and he didn't want to do them on this tour. So we're not going to do any Ozzy songs. We might do a couple of Badlands tunes sprinkled in here and there, maybe one or two a show. But predominantly, it's going to be this record and a few songs off the first record, you know? Because we're having a hard time picking which ones we want to do live, because we like them all.
Yeah, yeah. And it must be tough, because I'm sure that the fans have very specific, you know, each of them could have a very specific desire for the songs that they want to see Jake and you guys perform.
Yeah, I mean, we walk this really weird line, right? Because the band's called Red Dragon Cartel, but it's made up of guys who have past history in other bands. We're not like, okay, to use Lynch Mob again, we're not like Lynch Mob, where we'll play a legacy bill festival where we have marquee value as an opening act. Because Red Dragon's a new band, we might be lower on the bill because we're not called Badlands. We don't have that marquee value, even though it's Jakey Lee. Like, if he would have played, put it out as Jakey Lee, we probably would be higher up the food chain when it comes to legacy shows and tours and opening for bands from that era. But because we have a new name and it's a new band name, we don't have the pull in that world, even though we're people from other bands, you know? And it's kind of hard, where do we resort to the legacy act and put together a legacy set to open for a Queensryche or a Tesla? Or do we try to run the Red Dragon Cartel flag up the pole and try to get tours with, like, opening for a Rival Sons or, you know, a Greta Von Fleet or a Black Crows, you know what I mean? Or something like that. You know, it's like we're on this fence, which makes it very difficult.
That's interesting. You're a very compelling interview, Anthony. Honestly, you're a very fascinating guy. I enjoy talking to you, and I'm going to enjoy talking a little bit shit at you when the Flames are beating the Flyers in the Stanley Cup Finals.
Oh, my God. Yeah, when Johnny Hockey comes home.
Well, Anthony, we thank you so much for taking the time out to come on the show. We really appreciate it. This is our little segment, time for you to like that we borrowed a little plug your shit action.
Oh, I don't have to put. Oh, just listen to Patina. It's worth the 45 minutes to an hour just to listen to it, and listen to it once, and if you like it, buy it. But just at least it deserves. We really are proud of it, and we really took our time sculpting it and constructing it and making it something that we're totally proud of. And it's worth the 45 minutes to an hour to listen to it start to finish. And if you like it, pick it up and come see us live. But it deserves a listen.
Well, I can tell you right now that I sure hope that we get the chance to see you guys live, because just from watching the Bitter video, it seems like so much fun to go see you in concert. So that's a big time positive in my book.
We need to book our tour around the NHL schedule. Like when the Flyers or the Vegas Knights play the Calgary Flames, we should play Calgary that night and have the night off so we can go to the game.
We'd all go to the game together. We'd have a great time. We'd have a great time. We'll take you out on the town. Absolutely. Treat you to the Calgary's best and then go watch the Flyers lose one.
All I remember is it was like, isn't it like the Canadian version of Texas? Like, I remember this, we had a great steak there, and I remember it being, like, very, very oil and cattle, and there was a lot of snow when I was there.
Yeah, that's 9 months of the year.
That's pretty fair. Well, I hope that Patina does so well. Red Dragon Cartel is an excellent band. Anthony Esposito, you are an excellent interview, and I thank you so much for taking the time to come on the show.
And one more thing, if I could just put this in there.
Absolutely.
If we're not booked, if anyone listening, like anywhere, anyone listens to it, and we're not playing your city, there usually is one or two promoters in your city that book the bands of our ilk, you know? Don't be afraid to contact them, like online or at a show that you're at, if you go see another band and the promoter's there, and tell them, yo, when are you bringing Red Dragon Cartel? Because a lot of these promoters don't think that there's a demand for us, so they're not, you know, pushing for us to come there. And if they're not pushing for us to come there, we're not going to be able to play there.
That makes total sense. Well, I'll tell you what, we will do some pushing around and see if we can get you up here.
Awesome. Excellent. Thank you much. Have a good one. Go Flyers.
You got it in there.
All right. Bye now.
All right. Bye. Can you